So bombs those three, and then there was like a, that was like, for me, it felt like I'd been searching through all these different classes of drugs and finally found what I was looking for.
Hey everybody, so that was our guest today, Joel Iliff, who's got an amazing story out of Australia. He's been through the ringer, to say the least, as you just heard there. Hey, listen, the title sponsor for today's episode is FAR Canada. They are Families for Addiction Recovery. They're based out of Canada, of course, and their mission is to help families. So check them out, guys. They've got a lot of really cool things going on, some good resources. They are looking for some select volunteers. It's quite a process to become a peer-to-peer support worker, but might just be well worth the trouble. And in the very least, there's a ton of resources there for the families, guys. You know, here on Astros, and that's what we're looking out for, is the families, just as much as anything else, right? So check them out at farcanada.org. And in the meantime, here's the show. Supporters, well, guys, welcome to another episode of the Ashes Toss Podcast. I'm your host, Chuckle Flange, checking in from Krabi, Thailand. My guest today is from Byron Bay, Australia. Welcome to Joel Iliff. How are you doing today, Joel?
Yeah, good, man. How are you going?
I'm good. Three takes, peek behind the curtain, three takes to get that one right. So we got it. So yay for that, right? Name and location, perfect.
Yeah, top marks. But Mark's from
yeah, gold star, my chart. We're gonna take it. So listen, of course, we've been chatting pre-record, and you know, we've already done a little bit of chatting. So for anybody that's listening, I guess I'll just do a peek behind the curtain again here. Joel and I connected through my friend and fellow podcaster Paris on Shit's Fucked, who she's got an amazing show. She just appeared on our show. I'm scheduled to appear on hers here in a couple of weeks as well. So she was showing me your reels, and we tend to do this guest exchange thing, Joel. All the podcasters, she was like, hey, you know, I got a really good person. And I gave her a couple, like some gold nuggets. And you were the first person that she had suggested to me. So for whatever that's worth, you've got some esteem in the, at least in Paris's podcast world. So no pressure though. No pressure over here. Right.
Yeah. She's a fucking legend. So yeah.
Yeah, she is. Right. She is. Yeah, we've done some collab reels and stuff now together, and she's got some other appearances coming up on my show as well. I quite like working with her, right? So,
yeah.
Listen, Joel, let's just get right into it. The first time you got busted up, now that I've got the Australian slang down, right? There you go. So if you could take us back to that, it's kind of a good way to kick off your story, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So... yeah, first time busted up, I would be when I was like totally out of control. Would be when I took MDMA for the first time. I would have been would have been 19, and yeah, I was hanging out with some older boys, and I wanted to impress them. I wanted them to think I'm cool, you know. And we went out, had a few drinks, and went out to a nightclub, and I ended up having a pill and waited about an hour, wasn't feeling anything, and then begged them for a second one. One of the boys gave me a second pill, and so I bombed that. And then as it slipped down my throat, I felt the first one coming on. And then obviously the second one kicked in, and I was just a fucking menace, like freaking people out, like cruising around this nightclub, like trying to talk to people and like tell them how much I love them and all this shit. I could see the concern in their eyes, and they were just like, I still remember the look, this one particular girl looking at me, just like giving me the look of just like, can you just leave me alone? Like
I know that look really well from women, actually. Yeah Normally it's followed by, who are you, get out of my shower, but you know, right? So anyway,
yeah, so that was kind of the first time. Like
that's funny, man. That reminds me, and it makes me howl, actually. Both mushrooms and edibles, like weed edibles, I've said to people, I don't even know how many times over the years, right? I don't feel it. Don't take another one. Don't. Right? Because you're going to feel it. Like, it's going to happen, and you're going to regret the second one. And nobody ever listens, right? Nor did I ever listen, right? And then we all end up in the same place. You are going, holy shit, right? Too much. So, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. But like, okay, now that we got that out of the way, why don't you just kick us on into your story and how you tell your story, and you know, because you've done it 1,000 times, so yeah.
For sure. So I guess dialing it back a little bit, a few years prior, I think we had a bit of a family breakdown. So I was living in Perth on the other coast of Australia, on the western coast, and my mum and dad separated, and dad's flew back to England, which is where I'm from, where I was born originally. And so I was just living at home with mum, and she was going through a bit of a tough time too. In I was in high school, and in school I was getting bullied a fair bit there, and I looked a bit differently, I dressed a bit differently, I was kind of expressing myself in all this black and dyed hair and stuff, you know, I was kind of going through a bit of shit, so that was my way of dealing with it, and it wasn't well received by the other boys at the school, and so I felt like I didn't belong anywhere, and I was kind of getting picked on. I didn't really know who I was and what my place was, and yeah, I just wanted to be accepted, really, which I think is pretty pretty common for most boys that age, you know. And
of course.
Yeah, so and then I was prescribed Valium. Prescribed Valium when I was 17 for anxiety and a panic disorder. They thought I had, which I think was a catalyst for leading into my addiction. And so,
okay,
I was given these. Like it was how I the Valium being prescribed to me by a doctor. Right, I learned that I could take a tablet when I was feeling these uncomfortable feelings, like feeling anxious or this sense of panic or dread or whatever it may be, not feeling good about myself. I could take this tablet that was prescribed by a professional, and all of my problems would just suddenly go away, and I felt good about myself. And that I remember that being a huge moment for me, like realizing, hey, like these human feelings that I'm experiencing, like I don't need to, these uncomfortable ones, I don't need to. And so that kind of really opened me up to the world of drugs.
Did you at that point, Joel, really have that much introspection at that age? I mean, and that's a bit of a late bloomer age as far as drug using careers go. So I wouldn't be surprised if you did, but was it like, hey, or is that something that you can now go back with a bit of a hindsight and go, okay, that's what was happening within me?
That was, yeah, it's definitely a lot of hindsight now. I did not have that self-awareness back then. But
yeah, okay.
I guess I still had it. Maybe it was a bit more of a simple kind of thing for me. It was like, hey, I'm feeling anxious and shitty and horrible, and I now
have
this tablet, and then now I don't feel that way anymore.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Before we continue, there was something that you said that I kind of dialed in on, and a panic disorder or something that they thought you had.
Yeah, well, I kind of take that diagnosis with a grain of salt, because they were giving me this saying I had this disorder. I think it was just like a direct response to what I was experiencing at the time. My parents were separated, my dad had left the country, and I was getting bullied in school. I was also kind of like, mum was having a tough time, and I kind of took on this like parent role, and it just felt like they just gave me a label kind of put a bow on it, like, hey, oh, you've got a panic disorder, so yeah, take these pills, you know what I mean?
It's like, okay,
I don't feel a very holistic approach to my experience.
Absolutely. That makes perfect sense to me. I thought that answer might go, but I do have to ask. So anyway, continue on with your story. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No worries.
I did mean to, but.
No worries. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, from there, I was taking some Valium. I was getting bullied in school, started smoking a bit of weed with some friends, you know, often, a few times a week. That was that. And then finished school, got out of there and started experimenting with MDMA, kind of catching up to that part of the story, and using a bit of meth. It's kind of, once I tried the MDMA, I was like, ooh, holy shit, there's like a whole world of drugs out here that I want to try, you know. Got really experimental with it. I was trying psychedelics and stuff like that, and then the Valium, I then found Xanax, and it was like way stronger, and I thought, fuck yeah, I'm gonna use this. And so this is all about the age of 18-19, right? I'm starting to navigate through this. I started to deal drugs as well. I just started off quite small time, just selling a little bit of weed here and there, you know. But aside from like just earning a bit of extra cash, which is nice, the main attraction of it for me was the sense of like power, autonomy, control, acceptance that brought me, in terms of like
I can relate.
These these guys in school that were bullying me maybe felt like I wasn't enough. Like they were suddenly like hitting me up, wanting to buy drugs off me and inviting me to parties. And then that now got like girls interested in me. And like, I just felt like I'm the man, you know what I mean? Like I could see.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Could see a bright future.
Right. That's funny, Joel. And I'll interrupt again. You just articulated something that I didn't even realize about myself, you know, after all this time. But it was like, oh my, everything you just said right now, I just went, holy shit. So there you go. So thanks. Right. Now I have a whole nother avenue to start exploring about myself and my journey. But like, absolutely. I was an entrepreneur. I tried drugs. It just makes sense that I ended up being a drug dealer. Right. But
No,
there was so much more going on there. And you've just kind of opened my eyes to it. So thank you for that and continue. But
awesome. I'm sure you could be great at it as well. Like, I'm sure you were great at it. Because you got the gift of the gab as well. I'm sure you could talk anyone into anything, you know?
Well, drugs, here's the thing about drugs. It's not like a used car. This shit sells itself.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like that's a no-brainer, right? Yeah. But yeah, I was good at it, right? There's no doubt about that.
Right. Yeah. Well, you've got to be good at it too, you know? Because put it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Continue on with your story, though. Please do.
Dealing and that, yeah, get kind of like starting to build a bit of money and whatnot. And this is all kind of like running, coinciding with my drug use escalating and me experimenting with more things. I remember the first time that I felt addicted to drugs.
This one
moment I remember actually. So I was using Xanax every day, using meth, like just going on binges, you know. I'd be up for like 4 or 5 days at a time and do a big binge. And then I would just cruise on Xannies for a few days and then be back on the meth, this kind of thing. But I was so young and naive, I didn't see that it was a problem. I was just like, fuck yeah, I like to party, you know? And then I had a girlfriend. We rented a hotel room.
Yeah.
Just for a night, you know? We did that. And then like, I had a full on breakdown in the hotel room because I didn't bring any Xannies with me. And I didn't think it'd be a big deal. I was like, oh, I was smoking weed and that. And I was just like, yes, wait, like I'm just cruising. I think we're having a drink. And then I was just like getting worse and worse. And then I just like fucking broke down in tears and was like, I can't be here. Like I need to go pick up a bottle. And I remember that was a pretty intense moment. I was like, holy shit, I've got a problem here. That's on the Xannies. I really enjoyed the stimulants, right? Like the MDMA and amphetamines, whichever ones, and cocaine and stuff. But like for me, they were just bits of fun, right? And then the in between parts, like getting on the Xannies and the drugs, that really calmed me and brought me down. Like really helped me, and they felt like they were the ones I was attracted to. Really. Helped with my ADHD and anxiety and like racing thoughts and like this, I just brought me back to a baseline. So I could feel that they're so like dark and alluring, right? Like these calming drugs. And so I remember like thinking like, I want to experiment more with this and go down this slower avenue. And I remember I was 19 still, maybe 20 at this point. A friend of mine introduced me to codeine. And I remember it was like, they were called Panadeine Extra, the particular brand, like 15 mgs of codeine in the tablet. And I remember like, yeah, I think I'd taken them before for like a headache or something because they were over the counter at the time. My friend said, mate, this drug's sick. Like, well, you just need to take 3 of them, like, instead of the two that they suggest in the box, and you're going to get a feeling. And I remember like I was so nervous to disobey the rules on the box, even though I'd been fucking bombing Xannies and smoking meth and stuff. But because it was like a prescription, like because it's in like big writing and it's like, do not take more than this, like doctor's orders. I was like, oh, like the doctor's no better.
Oh, wow. So by that point for me, it was challenge accepted, right? You know, so continue though. Yeah.
So bombs those 3. And then there was like a, that was like, for me, it felt like I'd been searching searching through all these different classes of drugs and finally found what I was looking for.
That's a familiar story, that one is. I never got into opiates myself, so but what you just said there, I hear that, a version of that from just about everybody that ends up going down that road, right? So
it's like, wow. It's like a feeling of nostalgia, like being home, you know, like,
yeah. Boom, there it is. I was waiting for that or mother's hug. Yeah, those are the two. Oz, every time, right?
Mother's hug, you know. But yeah. That was when we get into the heavier opiates, right? When I'll go down that way. But I guess, yeah, I was like, this is it. This is the one. This is what I've been looking for. And from there, like these, you know, how I was saying, you know, I took like three tablets instead of the two. I started to bump up the doses, increase. Your tolerance grows exponentially, like very, very quickly. And and then I started extracting the codeine. So I'd run the tablets through like a cold water, like a very simple cold water extraction process, and extract the codeine so I could just drink it as a liquid. And then all the paracetamol and stuff, I wouldn't be ingesting that because that'd kill me. For the amount of tablets I was having, and then I'm like, and then I'm using the codeine daily and extracting 100 or 120 tablets each morning.
Holy cow!
Yeah, to over 100. You know what I mean? Like, it just kind of like, I was just like a person of extremes, and if I wasn't like completely fucked off my head, like it, you know, I wasn't satisfied.
So, yeah.
Yep. So going in and having just a couple and just getting like a little bit fucked up, my friends, like that was just didn't interest me. I wanted to really just go as far as I could with it.
Crazy.
Yeah, and I guess, yeah, from there kind of moved on to OxyContin because codeine wasn't strong enough for me. Oxy was, and I was dealing, right? And so using a lot of Oxy, using about 400 milligrams of Oxy a day, which was getting quite expensive. And I was just smoking it at this stage. And I was, my dealing had really increased too. So like I said before, I just started selling like small time weed. And then I realized, I'm actually quite good at this job. And then I started selling bigger amounts of weed and then selling to people so they could then sell, you know what I mean? Kind of like moving up the plane a bit. And then I started to like press MDMA caps and buy like thousands of things at a time. And was getting like a really good income from it. And it was like, this is like a career thing for me. I could do really well in this area. And it was still this like party mentality of like buying everything I wanted and like just having loads of cash everywhere, multiple cars and girls and parties and like all this kind of stuff. And it was all very lavish and I could kind of do what I wanted, which is the freedom and autonomy was really nice. And that feeling like I'm valued here. I'm like an important person in this world.
Yep.
And people want and need me. And when Oxy came into my life, I was probably, I would have been like 22, started experimenting with Oxy. And things shifted in a big way in a short period of time. So there was like a bunch of us that were kind of like dealing together pushing some bigger numbers. And we had big aspirations and I feel like we're moving in a good way, in a positive way, like achieving our goals in terms of money and amounts and stuff. And then and we're collaborating and working quite well. And then Oxy came in and then it became cutthroat and suddenly there was like there's like violence and stuff happening and people getting robbed and it suddenly became this like criminal. I know it was criminal before, like dealing drugs and
what. I know what you mean though. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So for me, it became less about, well, not for me, but like what I was seeing around me, it became less about the money and more about the lifestyle in terms of like the drug dealing lifestyle. And like, yeah, it was just hectic. Like the relationships changed and I didn't feel like I could trust anyone. And I felt like I would fucking rip anyone off for Oxy as well. You know what I mean? Like it just, it just fucking ran rampant through our whole circle. Anyways, I would have been about 24, been running this for a couple of years. Australia reformulated Oxy, so you could no longer crush it.
Okay.
So you couldn't smoke it or snort it or shoot it, whatever. I wasn't shooting yet. And so we all moved into heroin because that was like the next logical step in terms of getting the same fix and not getting dope sick from it, because like from oxy, like I was going into pretty heavy withdrawals when I wasn't using, so I'd be using all the time. Not being able to smoke it, yeah, like heroin was the next step. And yeah, like from there, kind of got onto the needle. Was it 24? And shit was just out of
control. Oh, so this is a relatively short amount of time then, and like that you describe what you're sounding like when you're telling the story. It's like it sounds like it's just happening over years. But really, this is a pretty short amount of time, relatively speaking, right? Like myself, I imagine you told yourself at some point you would never put a needle in your arm, right? Is that, right. What's that? When you do that for the first time, and I don't want to like do the whole triggering, how did it all feel and all that, but what do you say to yourself? Like, how do you justify that to yourself the first time? Or do you justify it to yourself? Is it something that just happens?
Well, for me, I was always afraid of needles and I was disgusted by them. And I was disgusted by people that chose to use them. And I thought I could never be further from something. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's just this like horrible, awful thing. And I recall the first time I used it. So I was at a party and I bumped into an old mate of mine, and we're both like pretty poor influences on each other. And I hadn't seen him in maybe a year. And see him there straight away. We're like, should we get some fucking Charlie? Should we get some Coke and like, you know, like get on with it kind of thing? And he's like, yeah, I know a guy. And we jump in a taxi and head to this house. And then on the front door, he turns to me and he's like, mate, I've got to be honest with you, it's heroin that we're getting inside. It's not Coke. And
so does he, like, he just wanted to get you there because he needed your money to kick in on it? Is that what it was? Or like,
no, I didn't pay for it. Like he had his own money. He was dealing.
Okay.
Know? We both had coin, you know, it wasn't the money thing. I feel like maybe it was just like the enabling factor. He just wanted some support.
Misery loves company. Yeah.
Okay. And I had a few bennies in me and I'd been drinking too. It was pretty, the inhibitions were pretty low, but I was pretty upset with him. And I was like, man, what the fuck? You can't, that's not cool. You know, like, I'm here for Coke. I don't use heroin. And we go in there and he ends up having a shot. Like the dealer kind of sorts him out and I'm sitting there a bit awkward. And anyways, I kind of resist for a little while. And then I said, well, fuck it. Then like, give me a line. I'm not going to shoot it. Just I'll snort it. And it just didn't really give me a whole lot.
And then, and of course, by this point, you've got a tolerance built up though too, right? So yeah, right, so for opiates in general. Yeah.
And then after I've had the line, I've kind of like broken the seal, you know what I mean? I'm like, well, all bets are off. Like I've just crossed my boundary already. So then I'm like, all right, can you strap me up, you know, and then kind of go from there. And then we do it and he fucked it up. My arm was just like a mess. It's horrible, man. Like I wore a jumper for like weeks afterwards, trying to like hide the evidence. And I felt so much shame about it. It wasn't just the shame of like, oh, what's everyone going to think? It was like the most damaging part was the relationship with myself, like how I'd let myself down and like done something that I swore that I would never do. I saw myself in a different light and I just thought I was like a piece of shit.
Right. So, but we have coping mechanisms built in for those feelings, don't we? By now, at this point in your drug career, you've already got a coping mechanism for feelings you don't want to feel. So I think I can imagine where the story goes, but I won't jump to assumptions. I'll let you tell how it goes from there. So
I've got something for this. Oh yeah, that's right. I'll go another shot.
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a level of desperation, man. That I just, today's my 18 month. Well, yesterday, today, whatever, because I'm 12 hours ahead of time than I used to be. Right. So it's my 18 month. And
is it, mate? Amazing.
Yeah, it is. Oh, thank you. And I tried to explain in a post, like, this desperation. And it's like, it's not the intensity of that desperation, because everybody has major points of strife in their life and where things have gotten really bad. And it's just, but it's you can't explain it to people that haven't felt it, because it's the nature of that desperation. It's this, you know, like, I'm desperate not to feel the things I'm feeling. The only way that I know how, or my brain, or at least my default to feeling things I don't want to feel, is to do the things that makes me feel the things I don't want to feel. And then now I'm just like, it's this weird, unless you felt it, you'll never understand it. Like, I'm going to do the thing that's killing me because it makes me not feel the things I don't want to feel, which only makes me feel those things more, to make it like, it's just this horrible cycle where at some point you don't even know where that snake eating its tail starts and ends. Right. And it's just, you're fuck in the middle of it. Right. So to try and explain that to somebody is really hard to do. Right. But yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I don't mean to interject and make it about me.
That's my only way out. Like, I'm using that. That's my survival.
Yeah.
So that was, I guess there was a few weeks of that, like, feeling that a lot of shame. I was still hooked on opiates, but I went back to Oxy. Didn't want to be anywhere near heroin. I was scared of it, and I was scared of how incredible I felt using it as well. Although similar to Oxy, there's a difference, you know. And I think I lasted a couple of months of just bucking around with Oxy again, trying to, like, pretend like it never happened, pushing it out of my mind, I guess. And then one day I was like, no, fuck it. I'm getting some, tried to smoke it for a few weeks, and then didn't last. And then mate, the fucking, this is grim, right? But like, I didn't know how to inject, and so I went on like YouTube and was like trying to do it following this YouTube video, and it, yeah, got your hand up. Yeah, you done
oh,
it.
Oh yeah. You probably watched the same ones I did, man. Right? Probably, right. Yeah. Yeah, okay. And that's, well, I almost guarantee, because there's only so many. There's surprisingly few videos about how to inject yourself, right? About the phlebotomy. That's how I learned that's what the art of extracting blood is phlebotomy, right? Or the profession of. So, yeah.
I it was like a crime scene, man. It was just fucking bloody. It was horrible, right?
Yeah. So, I just tell you, for me, man, I was never opiates, but I did slam meth. And when you miss with meth, it is the most excruciating pain ever. There is nothing I have ever felt that feels, and it's horrifying, horrible pain when you miss your vein with it, right? So yeah, there were some ugly days there, man. You know, when I was learning how, and fuck, it was horrible. Yeah, it's a nasty, nasty thing to go through, right? So yeah. Anyway, continue, please.
So here we are. I'm like, I'm only like 24, 25 around this point, slamming every day on the Zannies every day. And I think, like, I kind of touched on before, like, I'm slamming meth as well, and like other stimulants and stuff. But like,
okay,
that was just like these little pocket. It'd be like on a weekend here and there, blah, blah, blah. But then like say I went out on a night out, right, with some friends or something.
Yeah.
And we got on the stimulants, or I got on the stimulants, I would just be spending the whole evening like waiting to go home. So I can go home and get on the downers. And then when other people would be like, they would stop using, or stop, you know, say we went out and had some pills, some MDMA or something, when they would like be like, all right, the night's over, and they'd go to bed, that would be my time to shine. You know, like, fuck, this is my time. This is when I start doing my thing, getting on the downers. And then that kept me really lodged in this like addiction cycle of it being a never ending thing, because I could just link up these like the highs of the stimulants with the calming lows in between.
And
so I just never had to be clear minded. You know what I mean?
I do. Yeah. Okay. So continue. Yeah, please.
24, 25. From here, things just really went downhill when I started using heroin. I tried, like, it was out of control. I had a girlfriend for a while. She was a non-user. I didn't use anything. Didn't even smoke a cigarette. Like, she was proper She was really well behaved, and I was just a fucking psycho. And yeah, I tried different treatments. Like I went to detox a couple of times. I was I didn't really want to do this for myself at the time. It was just pressure from girlfriend or from my mum, this kind of thing. So I went to detox a couple of times, you know, like kind of stayed off it for a few weeks, for a couple of months after, and just got straight back into it. I was on like Suboxone, like buprenorphine for years. I think on and off since I was on the oxys, actually, since like 22, I was on and off it. And then I was on like methadone as well, which was just a nightmare. Didn't really do any good for me. But then like, and I've been dealing and like kind of making all this money for a while. And then it would have been like the age of 27, 28, when things just really went downhill, and like this earning thousands of dollars a week through dealing, like I was spending that on smack and drugs and all this other stuff. And yeah, split up with that girlfriend, and was just like living in these shitty backpackers around town, like these like squalors. It was real horrible places. And I'm just trying to like make money to get by, you know. And so it really changed my whole lifestyle. There was no more partying and stuff. It was like me alone inside, like just shooting, and like it was real isolating and dark. And I'd lost a lot of people out of my life, and they pushed me out of their lives. Enough, you know. And would have got, I was at the age of, I went to, I would have been, 28 or so, went into a mental health facility to address my addiction issues. I didn't want to be there once again. It was more of a pressure thing. And I ended up overdosing inside that rehab. Like I had drugs delivered to the rehab and then overdosed while I was in there. And they shut it down because of that whole situation. And then I came out of there, and then I was just overdosing all the time. So I had nine overdoses in 1 week following that rehab exit.
Wow.
And just like just doing crazy shit. Like I remember that first, so the first overdose after the exit from rehab, I picked up like a bag of meth and a bag of heroin, and the reason I got the meth is because I was like, oh, my tolerance is going to be low for the heroin, so I'll have a shot of meth first, and then I'll have heroin after, and it's not going to drop me, and then I pick both bags up, and I'm like, oh, actually, I'll just have one little bit of heroin first, and then I'll you know what I mean, like I'm just like, you know, and then I have heroin, and then I overdose, wake up in hospital, and then I say to the doctor, I'm like, hey, I want to leave. Like, can you just dismiss me or whatever they call it, you know? And she goes, I want you to look more. You need to look more energized before I release you. You look too dopey to be released to the street yet. And so then I head into the emergency room bathroom, and I've still got like a pick in my pocket and a bag of meth. So then I have a shot of meth in the bathroom. Come back out. The doctor says, oh, you're looking like way better, more energized. No worries, you can go, kind of thing. And I walk out of there like, ha ha, fuck yeah. Showed, you know, made her look a fool. Walk out into the hospital car park, crouch down behind like a car, have a shot of heroin and overdose again, and then get taken back into the room with the same doctor.
Oh my, oh
this geez. Happens days in a row. Like just this crazy situation where like I don't think, I got asked by a therapist, my psychiatrist, like, was I trying to kill myself? And I honestly, I don't think it was like a suicide attempt. It was more like I just stopped having the will to live. And it was just like, every time I would do this and have a shot, I guess being a heroin user mixed with benzo, like it's a fatal combination, like lethal combination, right? Like,
it really is
very high risk.
Yeah,
it was almost like every day I was making this decision of like, my pain is so extreme that I'm experiencing, I'm prepared to die to be free of that pain. And so it was like this matter of rolling the dice every day, like either I'm gonna be like so close to death that I don't need to experience this pain because I'm gonna be so high, like I have freedom from it, or I'm gonna die.
Yeah.
And that was it. And And I knew the risk, and that's why I was having so many overdoses.
When I say to people, or when people say, oh, you're doing drugs, taking the easy way, it's like, does anything about what you just said sound easy? You know, like there's nothing easy about that. You know, and so to try and explain that to people who might be judgmental, you know, because they don't have that experience or whatever, or, you know, or they lack empathy in some cases. It's like, there is nothing easy about that life, right? Like, this is nothing. So please, like, nothing, everything you just said, just, it just breaks my heart that another human being is going through that, right? So don't fuck off with your taking the easy way out, right? Like, there's nothing easy about that. That's a brutally hard way to live, man. I'm sure glad that you're still here with us after experiencing that. It sounds to me like you're getting to that point though, right? In your story, it kind of sounds like you're getting to that turning point. And if not, oh my, geez, hey, but please continue and, you know, let us, yeah.
For sure. I hear, and I think, there's a lot of stigma and misinformation and just, yeah, that lack of empathy surrounding it. And that's why I'm so passionate about sharing my story. And that's why I find it so inspirational to see people doing what you're doing and like speaking about this stuff openly. I think it's really important. Yeah. But yes, we are coming to some more positive, but I guess I should, so there's a little bit more heaviness before we might get there. I'm floating around, like I'm living in, this is following that string of overdoses. I'm living with, this one close mate of mine. In the backpackers, like he was a heavy meth user, I'm a heavy heroin user, and we're both just kind of like helping each other out. So I'll be like sick, withdrawing in bed, and he would like come bring me food and like force me to eat and stuff, and vice versa when he was coming down, and like it was all a bit of a mess. And I was really disconnected from everybody in my life. Friends had just kind of pushed me aside, and I'd push them aside, and like he was kind of like my only person.
Yeah,
and then he. Yeah. He ended up taking his own life, and, I just remember that feeling of like I've got nobody else. Like he was it, you know. And I mean, even those really shitty days, like we're living in this fucked backpackers, like full of like this real dodgy people. And I remember thinking like, even though I hate it here, like I've got him. And then he was suddenly gone. And then my dad, who's living in England, he suddenly died like 2 days after that, and from cancer, like just out of the blue. And that whole week was just fucked, you know. Like it's like, well, like what am I doing here, right?
Yeah.
And for me, it felt as though I was at like a fork in the road, like a crossroads, and there was two ways to go that I could see, and there was one follow down the same path that I'd done for so long, doing the same self-pity shit and keep using heavily and probably die pretty soon, you know, like I was almost there. Or the other option was to seek treatment, try to like, get some fucking help with this and try something different. And so I reached out to a rehab, and like it was like absolute process. It took months and months. They wanted me to prove engagement to them and arrive, like to attend this information group every week, pre-entry group they called it, because they wanted to see that I was serious about my recovery. And and that took months. And then I finally got in there. It's a place called Palmerston in Perth. Amazing, amazing place.
Okay.
And I was in there and realized that, you know, I tried these detox places before and other places, and because I hadn't wanted to change, I wasn't ready to change, like nothing had changed. And then it was amazing. I was in there for 8 months, and then I realized that I had so much to work on, and because I'd been wondering why has detox not been working for me in the past. Like I'll go in there, I'll do my 2 weeks, come off the methadone and smack and whatever, and then within a few weeks I'd be using again. I never understood. And then through this rehabilitation process where I was able to have all this time not being fucked up and start working on things, I was able to recognize that my substance use was the symptom of my problems, not my problems. And so just like removing that and putting it aside, I was actually able to address what was driving everything.
Wow, man. 8 months. That is a long time by North American standards, right? Like a very long time by North American standards, actually. It really is to be in a rehab. I think that's great, though. Typically, it's a 30 or 60-day stay, right? So, you know,
yeah, what say? There's a lot of short ones available, right? How I look at it is like a percentage thing. So, like, I think of my use, all in all, I turned 30 in rehab. So it was about, I started 19, whatever, like call it 10 years, right? 10 years of solid use. And for me to go into a treatment center and then do 30 days and expect to undo 10 years in 30 days, I'm like, fuck, I need
to. The math doesn't check out, right?
Time. And I know that it's possible and people do that. They go in and they turn it around. But for me, I needed solid amount of time. And then even just the aftercare and stuff. So it was rather than just looking at it as like, oh, I'm going to go do 30 days, go in, do that stuff, come out as a healed person. It's like, no, it's going to be a...
No, that's just the beginning of the healing, right? Yeah. Just the beginning of it. Yeah. Even for myself, who, you know, by the time I got to the Yatra Center here, and I'll talk about them real quick for the audience. Of course, you know about them, but our title sponsor is not Yatra for this episode, and I feel it's important to talk about them, Joel. So, located here in Krabi, Thailand, where I reside, they're a trauma treatment center. That's what they do. They treat trauma. You get a lot of addictions facilities that treat, you know, they talk about specializing in trauma, but they also specialize in 20 other things. So is it really specializing in anything, if you know what I mean? Whereas the Yatra Center is all about trauma, 100% about trauma, actually. Actually, when I was there, there was a girl from Australia, a girl from England, and myself, and another fellow from England. So it's kind of this whole, it's kind of cool because it's this whole group of people from all over the world. So it's different than your typical rehab or treatment facility, however you want to word that. I was a year sober. I was a year and 10 days sober when I got there. And my healing journey just began when I walked through that door. Really, like if I'm honest with myself, right? You know, and being able to address those things, all the trauma and that. Check them out if you're interested in them, guys. It's YatraCenter.com, YETR. There's my sponsor mentioned. I got to do that anyway, and it seemed like a good time to do it. So I didn't even say I got to do that anyway. I get to do it anyway. So I tell you what, man, if I won the lottery, I would send everybody I know, addictions or not, I would send them there for just from what I got to experience. This is just the most amazing thing, right? But, and you're right about the percentage thing. How do you expect to do anything? I expect to heal from anything in 30 days, really. And if you're looking at it as the start of a journey, then you know, I think your odds are much better at succeeding in that. So 8 months in, and then what? Like, and so I don't know how long ago that was for you now, Joel. How much? I hate even asking that question to people. How much clean time do you have? Because I think we've got too much on it. But,
oh, interesting. You know. I mean, okay. So I do not refer to. I don't like the term clean or sober, and so I won't use that term.
I'm there
because, like, I think it's. Like if you're for a couple of reasons, right? Like saying you're clean kind of like implies that you're dirty before. And also the measure of, I remember when I was early recovery and I was attending like 12 step meetings and stuff, and like that measure of like how long you've been off it for, we've been healthy for, however you want to kind of say it, clean, whatever, that for me just felt like a lot of pressure and like source of stress for people. Say they would have a lapse or a relapse, which is all part of the journey, right? And there's no shame in that.
I'd say it's like trying to follow a moth, that like a recovery journey, like there's it's not linear, it's not even two-dimensional, you know. It's like, oh, it's all over the place. Mine most certainly has been, you know, for quite a while. But anyway, continue.
So I want to normalize that lapse is part of it. And I'd hear people, they're really reluctant to go back to like a meeting or something because they'd be like, fuck, I don't want to have to tell everyone that I'm, you know?
Right there, man. Right there. My first 30 days, and I'm always careful here because I don't want to take away from the power that the 12-step community can have for somebody. And it really does for many, many, many people. My first 30 days doesn't happen without the rooms. There's no way. There is no way that I made my first 30 days ever as an adult, and I'm 46 years old, without a substance, without the 12-step rooms. But when I did relapse, what should have been a day and a half turned into a year because I couldn't go back. I couldn't go back and say zero because of that thing that you're talking about. You nailed it, right? Is it that the ego that's attached to your clean time, the shame that when you go back to zero, whether you know, and of course, most of the rooms are quite accepting of people and no, please come back, keep coming back, all the things, but that does nothing for the person experiencing it. It's just like, I don't want to go back and say zero. I don't want that white key tag again. I don't, you know, like, I don't want to keep doing that. And it took me a year, almost a year before I finally went back, not into the rooms even. I never did go back to the rooms, but before I finally embraced recovery again, which is typically how I refer to it. My post was 18 months of recovery, not 18 months of clean time. Right. So, you know,
amazing. Yeah. I love that terminology. Yeah. I think the terminology is such a huge, plays a huge part. And it's important to acknowledge that. I hear you. And I think like the 12 step meetings have so many beautiful benefits, right. In terms of like, connection, being out, having, a safe space to share your story with like people who fucking get it, that you can relate to. There's elements of like providing service, like giving back, that purpose, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
There's so many amazing things that are happening in those rooms, but then I'm just mindful of some other things that I don't quite gel with. And for me, like the early recovery stages, I went to a rehab that wasn't like strict 12 step. It was like the 12 step groups that are there as an option. And we encourage you just to try everything, which I think, like you're saying, you wouldn't have got through your first 30 days without the rooms. And like, I needed that early on as well, just to be around people.
The fellowship, right? The fellowship is like so important. It's so important.
Yeah.
When you say at a meeting, I need a ride to the meeting tomorrow or on Thursday, whatever. And this is an example I use. I'm like, watch what happens, right? Guaranteed. I don't care where you are in the world. Somebody's picking you up, yeah. You know, and that's just that because of that fellowship, right? It's just so important and such a big deal. I think you can't go wrong with starting your recovery journey in the rooms. Absolutely. Whether you move to a different path or not is, you know, different things. But I think most people should consider it. Talking in definites, but yeah, so
anyway, for sure. And I also think there's like humility in accepting that and going somewhere where you might not enjoy it or it might not be for you, but like as someone who's early in their recovery journey, I think that can really be beneficial. Like I'm going to go to these things and like I might not feel like I belong there and whatnot, but like just giving things a go is a great thing to do. But like for me,
well said. Yep.
I really what I was getting at before with like doing these meetings early on is I was introduced to the rooms and then I believed with how they kind of speak about everything in there as well and the steps, I believe that like that was like everybody in the world who was in recovery was in a 12 step meeting group, right? Just like my own shit,
yeah.
You know, yeah. And I just kind of thought, oh, this is it, this is all recovery tape, right? Have our own language and like we kind of keep to ourselves a bit and like refer to people as like normal people who are people who don't have addictions and this kind of stuff. And I thought, oh, this is all a bit like strange, it doesn't really sit right with me and like I don't enjoy it, but like, hey, I'm going to trust this process. There's a lot of people here, I hear they're clean time and whatnot, and it's quite, I admire that. It looks like they're doing,
yeah,
they've got some great,
yeah,
things going on. But I then became a trained, once I completed my rehab program, I became a smart recovery facilitator. And
We have another episode to do.
Oh,
actually, then yes, we do, because that's something I want to do a full episode on and have not. So
awesome.
Yes.
Well, smart.
Yeah. So yeah.
It is a beautiful tool.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to talk more about that. Most certainly we are. Yeah. I want to do a whole episode about that for sure.
Sick. Yeah. I love smart. We can definitely do that.
Yeah.
But for me, like, I mean, the whole smart concept is beautiful. I love it. And I'm still using it to this day for other parts of my career and work and stuff. But for me at that point, I was just introduced to other people that were in recovery too.
Mm-hmm.
And they, for me, like I remember meeting these guys and they just seemed like fucking cool. Like they seemed to me like I don't like the word normal, right? But like they seemed like just normal people as because I just come, I remember my first one, I'd like come from a 12 step meeting and then come to the smart recovery meeting, and these guys facilitating it, I was like there's no like secret language going on, there's no like identities and calling yourselves addicts and alcoholics and all this stuff. And then I didn't even realize they were ex-users, and then kind of found out halfway through, and I was like, well, like, I don't know. I was like, and then it just seemed like they were just living this regular life in touch with society. There was no barrier between like, oh, I'm a person in recovery, you're a normie. And this kind of, they were just like cruising, doing their own thing. I remember speaking to one of the guys running it, and I was like, hey, so you do, you're ex-user, you don't go to 12 step. And he's like, no, I don't really like 12 step, but I like smart. I was like, cool. Like, how long you been, you know, healthy for? And he's like, oh, you know, a few years. And I was like, how long have you been doing smart for? And he goes, oh, mate, well, smart's designed. You only really need to go between like 6 and 18 months at the very max, kind of thing. Like, it's not designed. It's not some program where you're designed to be going back every week, like a 12-step thing. Because like you kind of, you know, you have your addiction, right? You work on it. You work on your stuff, and then you move on. Maybe you want to come back and check in here and there, like whatever's going on. But like, it's designed as a bit of a program rather than just coming back all the time. And I just, for me, like some people, like there's obviously there's so many benefits to the 12 step of like get connected with those people. And I find other ways to find that connection in my life. But just like that freedom, the freedom that I could hear in his voice and like see in his being of just like, he wasn't tied to this identity of like addicts or alcoholic. You know what I mean? It was like very much looking at like looking at it as a past behavior. I just made a video about this on my Instagram actually yesterday. But like the example I use of like why I find the identity thing unhelpful, calling myself an addict or an addict in recovery or an alcoholic, whatever it may be. I feel like when I was doing that, I was trapped inside a box, right? I was trapped within this label, and I found it hard to connect with people who weren't trapped like that, and kind of be running in the same circles. And then I look at it as though, like, if we take away the drugs, and it's like you are a cigarette smoker for some time, and then you stop smoking cigarettes 5 years down the track. Are you a smoker in recovery, or is that just an old behavior that was serving you back then and you no longer engage in?
Well said, man.
Moving away from this identity, I found so much freedom, and I was able to explore who I was without this addiction dominating my thoughts, and like feeling like there was an elephant in the room, and you know what I mean? And then I felt, I never felt so connected with my community again. Until I released that.
100%. I totally understand what you're saying there. I totally understand you. And again, once again, this is, and it's not even the first or second time. You've done it a few times. You're articulating thoughts that I've had for some time now in a great way. So I'll be taking some of this with me as we move forward. But okay, so continue. I mean, the smart recovery. What's going on now with you? What's going on in your life?
Well, I live a pretty fucking good life, eh? Gotta tell you that. So I'm just very, very health focused now, and like very fit. I surf and do lots of yoga. I'm a yoga teacher. I don't teach a whole lot of yoga anymore, but like I did my yoga teaching after my smart recovery course.
Okay.
Which I found is incredibly, incredibly beautiful practice, and really helps kind of strengthen my connection with myself. And there's just so many amazing mental health benefits that I get from it. But then, I've been working in support for a while, 2 or 3. Oh, you asked me when I got healthy, right? So it was during COVID, when COVID was on, I was in rehab.
So it's been a few years now.
October 2020 is when I got out of rehab.
Okay. Yeah. So. You're 2.5 years kind of thing. Something like that. 3.5 years.
Something like that. Yeah.
October's the half year for me, so that's why I say, right? It's of course my 18-month being, you know, today. So good for you, man. Good for you. The yoga thing, I did that at Yatra. It's the first time I've ever experienced it. I thought for some reason that yoga was relaxing, and it was quickly discovered that yoga is not relaxing in any way, shape, or form at all. It's not meant to be. It's not supposed to be. Whoever told you that fucking lied. It is not relaxing.
Get you in the door.
Physically, it's one of the hardest things I've ever done. It's something that I really do want to get back into, though, because it was such a challenge for me, right? It was great. It was really good. And for somebody who realistically in 10 years hadn't done physical labor of any kind, any sort of physical activity, I'd just been dealing dope and doing dope, right? So like yoga was hard for me, really hard for me to start doing, right? But you know, yeah. Ice baths, do you ever try that?
I do it every day.
Do you really? Yeah. I love the ice baths, right?
I guess it's like it's that dopamine release, hey? Gives us
You know what it was for me? It, totally different than dopamine.
Yeah.
Though there is that. Like when I got out, it was like, right? Like it feel like one of those like extreme douchebags, like extreme, you know. But for me, I have ADHD in like a very, very acute way, right? Getting in an ice bath to make it for that 2 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever the goal is that day. If you focus on anything other than your breath, you're probably not going to do it, right? Like you need to be focused. Nothing has ever outside of stimulants given me that kind of focus, right? Just the chaos goes away for those few minutes, right? So for me, that was the real attraction to it, was just like, holy shit, man. And relaxing maybe isn't the right word, but my brain gets to relax. Because like, if you're not focusing on the breath, good luck, right? There's 10 bags of ice in there with you. And you know, like, so for me, that was really where it was. It was just like, fuck, this is awesome. And the only thing that ever helped me focus like that before was a shot at meth. Or a hoot of crack or whatever. For me, it was where the real draw is to the ice baths, right? Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. And I think like when in entering recovery, right, and this whole new world, like there's so many options in terms of what we can do to help us and in terms of health and wellness. So for you and me, like we love ice baths, but for someone else, that might be their hell. You know, but there's so many, they might enjoy going to yoga or like starting, like, they might enjoy doing a cooking course or something complete. Like there's so many different avenues you can go down, but it's just like finding your thing and what you're into.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Meditation is a good example. I have a really hard time meditating. Again, my brain just doesn't, it's like all the time, right? It's go, 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 go. But that's where the ice bath, it was just like, boom, right? Yeah. You know, just like, and really that's boom, that kind of sound effect where everything just goes, okay, right? You know, I absolutely love that. And I remember like my first one was like, I made it a minute. And by the time I was done, it was like five, six minutes or something like that, you know? And it was just like a feeling of accomplishment that, you know, you don't really get a lot when you're selling and doing dope for years and years at a time, right? Like, you know, yeah. You never get that feeling of, I just did that, you know, right? And when you do, it's being proud over doing a giant shot or something, or you know what I mean? Like, it's just ridiculous sources of fucking, you know, whatever you're looking for there. Yeah. But, you mentioned before we started recording, as we're getting to the hour here, so we've passed the hour mark now, you've got your Instagram page. You are studying to be an addictions counselor now as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm just about to finish my diploma of alcohol and other drug. And I've been working in rehabs and a youth mentor, and I do some just other kind of support, private support work.
That's fantastic, man.
I'm moving. Yeah. I've been writing my book for a while now.
So tell me about the book. Obviously you haven't written it yet, so you can't tell me too much about it, but what's the premise of that? Is it your life story? Is it something else? What's that about?
Yeah, it's a memoir. So it's a story.
Okay. Okay.
Of this addiction journey, essentially up my life up until now. Yeah, so that's going well. It's been on a bit of a hiatus for a few months now, but I'm gonna get that going again. I'm pretty excited for that. And then I'm releasing more. Like I was saying to you before, my TikTok has blown up, and I'm releasing more videos. And I've done like a few talks in like a TAFE and a rehab and support groups and stuff. And I'd like to do speaking on a bigger scale. So. More podcasts and finish writing my book, more videos, and moving moving in that direction.
That's awesome, man. I'm just double checking to make sure that your bio page has, yep, we've got your TikTok, your Facebook, and your Instagram on it. So, okay, yeah. That's good. On the website. So anybody who's listening, if you go to our website, A2A Podcast, and this, of course, will be the most recent episode, episode 236 it will be. There's a whole bio page on Joel in there. You can get links to all of his socials and all the things, right? So, and of course, when you come back on to talk about smart recovery, that episode will be attached to your bio as well. So that's what's really cool about that whole page, right? Is just, it kind of connects everything together. So yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Listen, Joel, unless there's anything else that you really want to touch on right now, we'll get into our next segment, which is the daily gratitudes. So it's my favorite part of the show. What you got for some gratitudes today?
Sure, let's do it.
So what you got for some gratitudes? Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were about to say something else.
That was an awkward silence. Hey, I'm not even going to edit that out. Fuck it.
What am I grateful for? I'm grateful for the opportunity to be able to share my story with people and to connect with people like yourself and Paris, people that are also in recovery and have experienced some similarities in their story and are having the courage to share this with the world, I think is just like creating such a positive impact. So just being part of that, I'm very, very grateful.
That's awesome. That's a great gratitude to have. And rest assured, there's more podcasts that, you know, we kind of got a whole network of people amongst us here. So I'm sure that you'll end up on some more here in short while, but
well, I hope so.
For myself, I am grateful for Dumbass, or Sunny, my dog, as we want to call him. I'm always grateful for him. He gives me a level of connectivity here in Thailand that's unreal. Because how do you not like a dog in a sidecar, right? Like, he's just one of those things where I get a chance to talk with people that I wouldn't normally talk with, or, you know what I mean? They just want to come up and see what the hell that's all about. So I do love him. I love him, even if he's a dumbass. also grateful to my recovery community, you know, 18 months in now, and it's crazy, man. We're all over the world. It doesn't matter where in the world you are. If you need resources, somebody, you know, if I don't know somebody in that part of the world, somebody I know knows somebody in that part of the world. And it just, you know, we've managed to connect a lot of people with a lot of things. And that's a really cool feeling, right? So that'll be a service, but I'm also grateful to every single person who continues to like, watch, comment, share, talk about, do all of the things down at the bottom of the screen that you know you're supposed to do in order to help us spread the message. So every time you do those things, you're helping me getting a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to make a humble living, spreading the message. The message is this. If you're in active addiction right now, today could be the day. Today could be the day that you start a lifelong journey. Reach out to a friend, reach out to a family member, call into detox, go to a meeting, pray, go to church. I don't care. Do whatever it is you got to do to get that journey started, because it is so much better than the alternative. If you have a loved one who's suffering an addiction right now, you just take the time to listen to our conversation here. If you just take one more minute out of your day and text that person, let them know they are loved. Use the words.
You are loved.
That little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings them back. Boom. Done.